Good morning. Thank you for getting up at such an early hour and joining us for what I hope is going to be a stimulating, provocative, and informative session on online learning, what college presidents and the public think about its future, and they think some rather different things. This is not the second game of the World Series, so if you're here for that, you need to go down the hall and west a little bit. Sorry, Phillies fans. What we're going to be talking about here is survey results from two surveys conducted by the Chronicle of Higher Education and the Pew Research Center. We are joined by a very august panel of presidents from three different types of institutions. I'm going to be moderating. My name is Josh Fishman. I am the technology editor at the Chronicle of Higher Ed. And I'm going to very quickly run through a little bit of data from the surveys. And then I'm going to introduce people who are much more qualified to talk about it than I am. And then they're going to talk briefly for about 5 minutes each. And then it's your job. Sorry, it's early, but you're going to have to work. You're going to have to stand up. These guys are going to be giving you some interesting information, some interesting perspectives, and I hope that you'll ask them some questions. Please, when you do, there's some floor mics around, or stand up in your seats and shout. Don't just raise your hands. Tell us who you are also. But we've got these camera lights glaring in our eyes, so it's going to be hard for us to see if you're just waving your hands. So, you know, jump up and down, go, hey, got a question. Anyway, here is our panel. We've got James J. Links from Bucks County Community College, Kenneth Hartman from Drexel University Online, and William Pepicello from the University of Phoenix, and me. Here's the first thing I want to call to your attention from these surveys, and I'll talk a little bit about the surveys in about 2 minutes, but learning online in a classroom, and what we can see from this slide is that there is a difference between the percentage of the general public surveyed who thinks that online learning is as good as bricks and mortar face-to-face learning, that would be 29%, and college presidents, who clock in at 51%, which means 49% don't think it's as good, but they're not here, I don't think. But that's a big difference, and we'll be talking about that, I hope. And there are some predictions that college presidents have about what's going to happen to online learning in the future, and wondering how in a couple of years, whether more than half of their undergraduate students are going to be taking classes online. And currently, in four-year privates, 11% are doing it. But presidents of four-year privates think that 37% are going to be doing it. You can see that the current numbers are all low single digits except for for-profits. That hits 20%. But then the 10-year predictions are all up around between 30 and a high of 65%. So online learning is predicted to grow. That is very much in line with Sloan Consortium studies that say that it continues to grow and will continue to grow over the next 15 years. There are different patterns of online learning by sector. This is the percentage of college presidents saying that their institutions offer online courses. The highs are at two-year publics and privates, 91%, followed by four-year publics, and then you've got four-year privates at the low, and something that surprised me, that for-profit institutions were right there in the middle. And those are the big talking points here. that I want you to consider. And the two surveys, one was conducted of presidents of two-year and four-year public, private, and for-profit universities. They were surveyed online this year. That was contrasted with another survey, also done this year, of about 2,000 adult Americans who were surveyed by telephone. These were all done by the Pew Research Center, and that's the title of the survey. That's the URL that you can get the survey at. It was published in August 2011, and that's where we are. And to discuss all this, we've got William Pepicello, who is the president of the University of Phoenix. Dr. Bill Pepicello holds both master's and doctoral degrees in linguistics from Brown University and has held faculty positions at the University of Delaware, Temple University, and the University of the Pacific. He has held a number of administrative positions, including department chair for classics at Temple and regional dean for Southern California for National University. He came to the University of Phoenix in 1995, where he served as the first dean of the College of General and Professional Studies, subsequently held the position of vice president of academic affairs. At the time, until 2000, at that time, he assumed the position of the president of the University of Sarasota, and he helped transform that institution into what is today known as Argosy University. Bill returned to the University of Phoenix, and in September 2006, he was appointed president. And as president, he is responsible for the leadership of the largest private university in the United States. Kenneth Hartman is the president of Drexel University Online, just a local boy. Dr. Hartman has served the past 30 years as a university professor, academic administrator, and a consultant at several leading universities, including the University of Pennsylvania, the University of Delaware, New York Institute of Technology, and Drexel. Before becoming president, he served as senior vice president for marketing and business development and Drexel's academic director. He is the founder and national chairman of National Distance Learning Week and received numerous awards, including the 2007 Penn Educator of the Year Award from the University of Pennsylvania and the 2008 Leadership in Distance Learning Program Administration Award from the United States Distance Learning Association. Dr. Hartman holds an undergraduate degree from the State University of New York at Genesee and a master's degree from Michigan State University and a doctoral degree from the University of Pennsylvania. James J. Lynx, our third panelist, is the president of Bucks County Community College. Dr. Lynx has been president of Bucks since 1992. It is a comprehensive community college serving 630,000 residents in Bucks County, which is northeast of Philadelphia. The college has approximately 11,000 credit students and 20,000 non-credit students and 70,000 emergency service registrants, a staff of 500 full-time and 800 part-time, and an annual budget of $83 million. He was dean of instruction at Rappahannock Community College in Glens, Virginia, from 1971 through 1975. At Catonsville Community College in Catonsville, Maryland, not far from me. Nice to see you. He was dean of instruction from July 1980 to July 1992 and was professor of arts and humanities and chairman of the humanities division from 1975 to 1980. He has a bachelor's degree from Dartmouth College in art and architecture and a master's and an EDD from Columbia University in higher and adult education administration. So these are three folks who can really tackle this problem and this discussion. And so first, I'd like to turn the mic over to Bill Pepicello.
All right. Thank you very much. Are we on?
You're on.
Okay. I'm just going to say a few words about, we've been asked to talk about trends that we see, the future of online, and a few words about quality. And not going to talk too much about statistics, but sort of what they mean in the broader context of higher education in society. Overall, clearly there is more online activity today, and it continues to increase, although it may be adopted unevenly across higher education, which shouldn't be surprising, because the adoption of online is often a function of the size of an institution, its mission, and the institution itself. That is it primarily a small brick-and-mortar institution, or is it an institution whose mission is, in fact, growth and increased access? And, in fact, probably as much as anything, the future of online will deal with access, but increasingly we need to understand that means responsible access. The fact that online does make higher education and education in general more accessible does not mean that we now have an open admission system that absolutely has no barriers to it. And that's something that maybe we can talk about in the question and answer part. Now, there's a need in that regard to balance access and the ability for students to succeed, which is one of the criticisms of for-profit higher education today. But certainly, I think some of the steps that you're seeing universities take now speak to that responsibility, where we are trying to find the students who can best benefit from higher education. A key of online education, at least in my mind, is to integrate higher education into people's lives the way the rest of society has been integrated. Higher education is monolithic and lags behind the rest of society in some respects. People don't see a great difference between an online bank and the brick-and-mortar version of that bank, except that they go to one for some services and another for other services. In higher education, we've not yet reached that level. Education is something where you must stop what you're doing, go to a different physical location, isolate yourself, get educated, and then reintegrate yourself back into the real world, as we call it, which has an interesting implication for higher education, which is that it's not the real world. And there's no reason why it shouldn't be, and why we shouldn't integrate it in ways that the rest of our society is being integrated. And that means introducing things like adaptive smart platforms that recognize people and adapt to their needs as they work on it. A greater introduction of social media and applications so that people can access higher education from a variety of devices. And certainly one of the trends that we're seeing at the University of Phoenix, surprisingly enough, is a move away from pure online to a more blended approach. So we tend to think in terms of, well, you're either online or you're in the classroom. And increasingly what our students are telling us is that essentially, to paraphrase an insurance ad, our students want technology when they want it and people when they don't, and vice versa. And we're finding that putting together physical facilities where online students can come and go, as well as classroom-based students, may be a significant trend in the future. So, by and large, the question for the future is not whether we should be adapting online, but how we will do it, because it is inevitable. And a last word on quality. This is an interesting conundrum for me, because if presidents don't think that online has quality at their institutions, then how does that reflect on what they think is going on in the classroom? If it's the same faculty and the same syllabi and the same outcomes, we would assume that the quality would follow. And in fact, that's a basic issue here. which is that quality in online education goes to the basic tenets of higher education: curriculum, faculty, and outcomes assessment. Higher education traditionally has been a cottage industry, faculty-centered, faculty-controlled. Not that there's anything wrong with that. I did it for 25 years. But in the future, in order for online to prove its quality, it must be replicable, must be comparable, it must be transparent, and it must be accountable. I sort of sound like Margaret Spellings there, don't I? But in any event, it needs to be scalable in a responsible way. I think with that, I'll shut up.
Okay. Thanks, Bill. Next, Jim.
Josh mentioned that community college presidents tend to be very bullish on distance learning, and I certainly am in that category. I've been involved in one way or another in promoting distance learning since the mid-1980s, when the college I was at had its own cable station, and it essentially offered distance learning online and in collaboration with the Maryland Online Service. So I'm committed to it both pedagogically and practically. The reason I'm bullish on distance learning, essentially, is because it fundamentally changes the classroom dynamic, the classroom paradigm. And I think the most important thing about distance learning is not actually the availability of the courses online, but the way in which it focuses faculty members on the learning process and how students learn. And it allows us to do a number of different things in different ways than the traditional classroom environment does. And as far as I'm concerned, and Bill mentioned it as well, I think the most important thing that's happening is that distance learning techniques are migrating back into the classroom, so that while students not only are blending their distance courses and their face-to-face courses, but I think faculty members are blending the way in which they teach distance learning and face-to-face courses. So I think there are a tremendous number of interesting things that are occurring as a consequence. We're able to offer courses like speech online. We're able to do science labs online. We're able to create collaboration tools that work both in the distance environment and in the face-to-face environment. We are able to use learning spaces that allow certain kinds of interactions that weren't really possible or aren't really possible in the traditional classroom, whether it's note sharing or lecture sharing or asynchronous activities that allow students who are ill or have otherwise compromised schedules, very often the case at community colleges, can catch back up on the work that they have missed, which they would have otherwise missed totally. Many of us who have been classroom teachers, understand that famous line when a student comes in after being gone for 2 days and say, "Did I miss anything?" distance learning allows a slightly different response to that question, which is, go look it up. Testing technology and a variety of other ways in which we can promote interesting ways in which to actually figure out whether students are learning what they're doing, whether it's simple things like integrating clickers or much more sophisticated technologies that I think are either now available or will shortly be available, to actually figure out whether or not students are actually online, actually learning, actually not sitting there with their textbook open, actually not also on Facebook at the same time that they're taking your class. I think the people that are less bullish on it come from faculty environments in which there's the most insecurity and the most tradition. From my perspective, I think the way you get around that is by, A, having an outstanding program in which faculty members learn how to use the distance learning and learn how to do it well, so that you kind of demystify the process. And secondly, have ways in which your faculty feel equally valued for teaching distance learning as they do for teaching online classes. And by valuing it, I mean not only in the way in which we assign their credits, but the way in which we assign their pay. Value works both ways. Clearly for us at the community college, the majority of our students are actually not one or the other, and Bill noted that as well. So while our success rates in distance learning are in the high 80s and match our face-to-face experiences, the truth is the majority of our students are migrating back and forth between these platforms. We don't have a whole lot of students who are totally online students. Because we are a community-based organization, 95% of our students are in-state students, 92% of them are essentially in-county students. We serve those students in a variety of different ways. Their lives change. We have to be flexible in the way in which we deal with them. And that, I think, is why we need to keep doing it and why we got into it in the first place. I do think the biggest issues we're going to face as an environment, if you will, as a business in the business model, is that the globalization that we're seeing all around us is also the globalization of learning. There is no reason now why students can't take courses from Phoenix and Drexel and Bucks simultaneously. There's no reason why the very best professors in our entire nation aren't available to a set of students. We haven't figured exactly how that's going to work, because our model is a very local model. That is, you raise your own money, you serve your own students, and I think we're going to have to get out of that model fairly quickly. The accountability issue Bill mentioned at the end, and that is very, very important on the front side as far as I'm concerned. We expect the same standards, the same performance. We use the same learning objectives in our distance courses as we do in our face-to-face courses. That's an exceptionally important metric for us. We know that students who complete our online courses are essentially completing the same assessments as the students who are on campus. And obviously, we've adopted other metrics, such as the Quality Matters metric, try and integrate that into our what we call Distance Learning 101, the course we teach for faculty members that they have to take before they actually get online. And we try and make sure that those Quality Matters rubrics are used in our courses, even if we don't actually try and get the QM stamp of approval for every single course we offer. So we're excited about distance learning. We think it has a great future. More than 20% of our FTE production at the college in terms of credit students are online at this particular point. Probably double that percentage of our total student body has taken one or more distance learning classes. And one of the things that we're planning to do, Josh talked about the fact that one of the particular specialties we have is in the area of emergency services training, where we did 70,000 registrations in emergency services training globally. We think that's a terrific platform for us to use for some of that global training that we do with the Department of Defense. So I'll leave it at that for the moment.
Thanks, Jim. Also, thanks for bringing up that interesting point about the globalization versus local model, because it's kind of a plug for another session that we're doing at 5 o'clock today in a room right next door on the future of the unbundled university. So, you know, if you're still on your feet, try that one. Ken Hartman doesn't have to get on his feet, but he can talk to us now.
Thanks, Josh. Good morning. A little bit about Drexel University. We are located, I guess, about 20, 25 blocks from here. Drexel University is a comprehensive institution with a law school and a medical school and about 26,000 students. About 15 years ago or so, the then president of Drexel University, the late president, Papadakis, decided that he wanted to at least get a toe into the online world, not quite sure where it was going, but if it was going to take off in the private, nonprofit sector of colleges, he wanted to be certainly up at the top of the pack. And so 15 years ago, the college started with a small number of online degree programs, nursing, one in IT. 15 years later now, we have over 100 fully online degrees, making us, if not the largest, certainly one of the largest colleges in the nonprofit private sector, with over 8,000 students enrolled in one of those matriculated programs. What makes us unique, certainly on this panel, is our tuition. Drexel University, like a lot of you who work at a private school, isn't cheap. $650 a credit undergraduate and over $1,000 for a graduate credit.
So it is a very, very expensive product, and when you're competing both locally and internationally these days because of the internet, it certainly keeps us on our toes. Let me say a few words. I'm not going to repeat some of the good words that Jim and Bill mentioned, but I will share with you a couple of observations. A year ago, almost at this time, I was presenting at the Sloan Sea Conference, and I know probably many of you have been there and may be, in fact, planning on going there again in November. I was asked to present with a paper that I had published, co-authored with a colleague of mine in their journal, the title of which was something to the effect of 10 economic and demographic factors that will impact online and blended learning in the future. It's available, I'm sure, on Sloan's website, and if you have the journal, I believe it was published sometime in the winter of last year. So we had we were set that morning to in essence respond to people who had read the journal article and had questions, and it was the last morning of the last day of the conference, and we didn't really think anybody was going to be there, and of course we were surprised. The room was packed. And I remember saying to my co-presenter and co-author, Kristen Betts, as she was sitting outside the room on her laptop finalizing the presentation, that we had to change the whole thing. And she looked at me and she said, "Ken, we're starting in about 5 minutes. How are we going to change the whole thing? We've already..." And I said, "Did you see the paper this morning?" And she said, "No, but you're leading off, so whatever you want to do, go knock yourself off." Well, that morning, it was actually Friday morning, earlier that week, there was a story, and you recall the elections, midterm elections were held then. And on the front page of the paper of the Wall Street Journal was a story that I asked those members in the audience how many had read the paper that morning, seen the Wall Street Journal. No one did. And I said, "But there's a story on the front page of today's paper that will have a huge impact on what we do both face-to-face and online. Does anybody know what that was?" And, of course, they kind of snickered because it was right after the election. They said, "Oh, it was the election results." And that wasn't it at all. And I turned them to the inside of the Wall Street Journal and that day on page 5 or 6, and it started talking about many of the economic indicators, including on election day when people were either cheering or crying in their pretzels, the Federal Reserve had monetized the debt that same day. And we started talking a little bit about that, and I said, "You've got to keep an eye out for that. You also have to keep an eye out for some recent regulations that were coming out of Washington that deal with program integrity." And most people a year ago hadn't even dealt with that issue at all. And, of course, now you can't go anywhere or any webinar or look at any place where people aren't charging you lots of money to help you try to navigate through those waters. So all of this is to say that those of us that have been, you know, in this field for 30 or more years, I respectfully say to you that I hope you enjoyed the ride as much as I did, because the party's over with. We are truly looking at in my opinion, a whole new model, higher ed 2.0, if you will. If you need to look for any evidence of that, I would invite you to take a look at yesterday's USA Today above the fold: student loan debt surpasses $1 trillion. Burden could drag economy into future. And if you really want to get depressed, I go back 2 days to the Wall Street Journal. Bleak news for Americans' income. Pay fell 7% in the last decade. Economists say it will not catch up before 2021. Even college graduates see salaries slide. I don't need to tell you, if you watched news last night, you saw what was happening in Greece and earlier this year in California. Those are college students that can't find jobs. And there was a report that came out earlier this week that, again, if you have not seen, I invite you to go to, called Time is an Enemy. The name of the report is Complete College USA. The title of the report, again, Time is the Enemy. And just to share with you some of these results, some of the findings they found that you would know, just a couple of them. Part-time students rarely graduate. Students who take are taking too many credits and too much time to complete, and it talks about how poorer students are struggling to graduate. And as we all know, the graduation rate, both whether it be online, part-time, or full-time, is in some cases less than 30% in some certain sectors. So the model is clearly broken, and it has been for some time, but we have not had to deal with some of the other elements that are out there. My feeling or my suggestion is that the Higher Ed 2.0 and 3-5 years from now, I truly believe what we our field will look radically different than it is right now for many students, not all, but for many students. There will always be a places for the nifty 50 that are out there and the people who are able to afford that experience. But for the majority of colleges, I think it's going to be radically changed. But the one thing that I think we all could agree on that will be the same is the goal. The goal will be the same, whether it be online, blended, face-to-face, and that's simply to achieve certain learning outcomes, certain learning objectives, whatever those happen to be. And I think our elected leaders, if we don't get our act together, will define those outcomes for us. But the one thing that will also stay the same, and I think the key to that objective, and I'll throw it back to Josh in this note, is the one word that I think will ultimately make the difference between those programs, be it online, face-to-face, blended, that will be the winners and those that will have a difficult time in the years to come. And that one word is engagement. Engagement. The institutions that are going to be, that are going to find newer technical ways to engage students, be it online, face-to-face, some blended model of some sort, will be the ones that will be the ones that will succeed in the future. Those that will continue to look at the old traditional model, unless, again, it's my two cents, unless you're in that nifty 50, are going to continue the struggle. So the last thing I would say, because we had a conversation with this gentleman up front earlier, and it's a similar conversation I'm sure all of us get every single week, someone calling saying, how do I move my program online? What's the secret to going online? What are some of the things? And I go back to that one word, engagement. And if you're not engaging students face-to-face, you'll never engage them online. It's all about the leadership, and it's all about understanding and having the leadership at the institution get the word out as soon as possible to their colleagues that it has to change, because the world in which we're living in now and the country in which we're living in is changing radically. So on that note, I'll throw back to you.
Okay. Thank you, Ken. So we're moving to the question part of the program. Just to remind you who's up here. That's who's up here. I'm going to take moderator's privilege, and I'm going to throw out the first one. Ken, you just said the model is broken. You favored us with some not terribly optimistic news about the economy in the future. We've seen from this survey that the general public generally doesn't trust online education. You've all talked, though, about how online education techniques and technologies are creeping into higher education in general, in some cases not creeping, but moving as a thundering herd. And all college presidents believe that in 10 years there's going to be a lot more online education. So my question is, what's going to happen that's going to get us from here to there that makes you think that in 10 years there's going to be a lot more online education, when right now the general public doesn't like it, and that there are big economic and institutional barriers to it? And Jim, maybe I can ask you to start off on that.
I would not presume to decide what the public is going to do, but let me just suggest that I think the tide is inexorable. I just kind of made a couple of quick notes from looking at what's been going on just in the Chronicle and other places. Apollo buys Carnegie Learning. Kaplan is developing Connext for prior learning assessment. Capella is developing online courses in specialty areas for other colleges. The prospect is that some of our major online institutions, maybe Bill will talk about that, are going to follow the IBM model and move from selling directly and providing services to distance learning organizations. There are these movements for open education resources and open courseware. James Madison is now using Rosetta Stone instead of its own faculty to develop classes, or at least in some of the language disciplines. I just think that the value proposition of the way that colleges are evolving is, in fact, going to be, as Ken suggests, something different a decade from now. But it's going to be a decade in which we see more and more of our digital native students coming to us, whether they're coming to high-cost programs, whether they're transitioning into adult learning and going to Phoenix or Strayer or DeVry, whether they're students who need to be at home and are in the same area where they've grown up and are working and are coming to community colleges. However that's happening, I think we all have to assume that there are going to be bigger changes ahead for us, and our faculty and staff are going to have to adapt to those changes. Whether or not it's going to be the same model, just electronified, I think is the really big question. Right now, we've been moved from a kind of, I'll call, evolution rather than revolution. The evolution has been adopt distance learning, use some of those distance learning techniques in your classes, and just take regular course-based, semester-based materials and do something with them. I think the whole idea, there's an interesting article, I think, in the Chronicle this morning about is the traditional semester-based really gone already. And I think many of us, particularly traditional colleges, are still just kind of really hung up on the traditional base. Our winter session is 100% online, for example. So we've already said, okay, we're not even going to do it that way. If you want to take a class in our winter session, we're not even offering it face-to-face. So I think lots of things are changing. I'm not sure exactly where that's going, but I do see much more of a merger of business models and traditional college models.
Yeah, if I could pick up on Jim's comment, I think you're spot on. What we're starting to see and is the realization that soon we were going to hit a pivot point with online learning. Today, as we all know, 90% of students who are in a fully online degree program are adults. And if you go to campus, and including my own, you talk to folks, they're still in denial that traditional age students are going to want a fully online degree program. They'll look at you and they'll say, no, you don't understand. They want the dorm life. They want the girlfriends. They want the boyfriends. They want the pools. They want the sports teams. And I continue to go back, again, Mr. Doom and Gloom, I'm sometimes called, and say there's a difference between wanting and affording. It was the Rolling Stones that said you can't always get what you want. Sometimes you get what you need. And I think you're finding more and more parents who are looking now at Mick Jagger's famous quote and saying, you know, I need to get what I need. And I think the pivot point will come when these institutions, whoever they are, and I, if I was a betting man, which I'm not, I'm going to put my dollar on the for-profits with very deep pockets and able to build these courses. But it's going to be the institution that builds that highly engaging, highly measurable, outcomes-based online course at a fee that under $10,000 a year that will break the mold. And and who does that? I'm not sure. But I think there's going to be a race, which is why you see some of the acquisitions right now that are going on. They're putting their pieces in place so they can build that model. Because, as I said earlier, you know, it's not a question of what they want. There may be a rationalization. I've got a daughter who's a senior right now in high school, so we're going through the process all over again with her. There may be a decision that will say, well, you know, let's just do the fully online as an undergraduate. That way you can work. You can save money to pay for graduate school, and we'll have that experience on the other side. I don't know, but I think three to five years from now we'll hit that pivot point.
Yeah, if I could just follow up on some of that. I mean,
fire away, Bill.
To take minor issue with the statement you made, Josh, which is the public doesn't seem to like online. Uh-huh. I don't think it's that they don't like it. I think it's they don't understand it yet. They're not familiar with it. And again, I go back. I don't think it's appropriate to compare higher education to banking, but
yeah, you will.
I will, of course. When online banking came in, it was the same sort of thing, and using ATM cards and sort of taking banking into the digital world. And I was one of those people who went kicking and screaming and said, "No, I like the people at the bank, and I like to go in and see them." And I still do, but only when I want to. And I don't see the array of services that I get as being different. And I think because of the nature of higher education, which is that it's always been the case that the locus of knowledge was the faculty. And the faculty took knowledge and poured it into the empty vessel of the student. And I think that model is now not sustainable for a number of reasons. First of all, the economic model is not viable in the long term, and I think we've heard that at least implied in the comments of my colleagues here. A higher education model that's agrarian based, where we still have summers off so that people can go out and harvest the crops, is probably not sustainable in the long term, or one where research universities, and I think there's a great place for those, also have somewhat of a teaching teaching mission, even though sometimes I think it's in words only. I think that the model is, as it is highly inefficient just from the amount of work that gets done. Also, frankly, the economic model is falling apart simply because of funding. State funding is increasingly difficult to secure. In many states, the amount of funding for public institutions is now below 10%, which makes me wonder how public they are. Most of the point that we need to think about is the model that I talked about as a cottage industry where faculty are the holders of knowledge. Those days are gone. Knowledge is everywhere. The internet is full of all sorts of sites of varying quality. Wikipedia, which is, even though it is somewhat controversial still, I'd be willing to bet that at least 90% of the people in this room have been on Wikipedia's site in the last week for one thing or another. And I think it's incumbent upon those of us in higher education to take control now while we can. To say, yes, we understand that there's all sorts of information out there. A lot of it's bad. But we can be the filters. We can be the people who help control it, who help direct students in productive ways. And lastly, I think there was one article in the Chronicle that you missed, Jim, and that was several days ago. The model, people were talking about the Apollo Group, of which I am a subsidiary member, also has started a new subsidiary called Apollo Educational Services, which is designed to take best practices and make them scalable and available to other institutions.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. Questions, comments, please, because I'm starting to lose my voice. Fire away.
Based in modality, but on the individual experience. I think when I look
Mm-hmm. Yes, please. And who are you, by the way?
John Reisman with the Air Force Institute of Technology.
Great. Thanks, John.
The question I have is, we're talking about different models. The difference right now in the face-to-face environment between a three-credit course and a four-credit course is in the three-credit course, we could probably see 3 days a week versus 4 days a week for the four-credit. When you get into accreditation, people ask you the question, why is this a three-credit course? That model kind of breaks down the
Again, I think we start from the premise that it's the learning objectives in the course that are important. And so if you start from that premise and you're comfortable with the difference on your campus in a face-to-face class between a three-credit experience and a four-credit experience, I think you're going to be comfortable with the learning outcomes that you have in an online experience. In neither case, whether it's 3 credits or 4 and you're online, can we actually describe how many hours student X spends in his or her seat versus student Y. So I think that the accrediting agencies are becoming a little more knowledgeable. And interestingly, as they really stress accountability as a measure, I think the use of non-time-based techniques will also grow, and this question will essentially go away. If you really can show that a student can perform at X level on a face-to-face exam, and you use that same exam in an online class, and the student performs equally, I think pretty soon you can say, we are accountable for the learning that's occurred in this class. And the change, the big change, of course, that we've talked about for 20 years is the movement from the sage on stage to a much more collaborative process. So the focus on learning as opposed to the focus on teaching.
Okay. I know there are other answers to that question, but I know there are also other questions. I saw hands up here. Yes, ma'am.
Well, again, I think I just got last week some of us were at the President's Forum in Washington, D.C., and this was the big topic there in terms of what outcomes were. In other words, it goes back to the age-old question of what is it that we expect a college graduate to know and be able to do? And the consensus was that unless we as an industry can come up with those, they will be self-imposed, no different than what's happening, of course, right now with the K-12 arena, where you see the compacts between states, because the states couldn't get their the school districts couldn't get their act together, and so nor the states, and so now the feds are coming in and saying, if you guys don't come up with what it is, we will. Whether that will continue to go into higher ed level, I don't know, but you know, who would ever thought that 5 years ago, we'd have congressional hearings on the cost of textbooks in Washington, D.C. So, the whole outcome, that's a discussion that we could spend 3 days on, what students know. And again, what the consumer expects and what a faculty in an institution expects could be light years of a difference. So, and it has to be worked out.
That's a good point, and it's something that we need to address. And it goes back to the credit hour question, because one of the other things we're looking at now is how do we define a credit hour? You know, we have traditionally defined it in terms of Carnegie unit, which is really not and has nothing to do with outcomes. It has to do with funding primarily. But
to talk about how we develop our curriculum at University of Phoenix, it's all outcomes-based and has been since we were founded in the 70s. And we align outcomes not only for student skills and learning, but then match those to the job market now. Because for better or worse, higher education has moved that way. And even in liberal arts institutions, people want to know, what am I going to do with this degree? Which was not the case when I graduated, for instance. Or I'm not sure I would have taken Latin and Greek and linguistics as my majors. But the key here is to have measurable outcomes embedded in the curriculum. And that's what we do. We align industry standards to accreditation standards to workplace standards and map those through the curriculum, assess them, and we can actually point to those outcomes that students have mastered and show how they have mastered them. And I think as we move forward, and again, I think that was implied in the comments here, I think we're going to see a movement in that direction where we will focus on the outcomes and the demonstrated learning as opposed to the inputs.
Time flies when you're having fun. I think we have time for two more quick questions. Or we don't. We're done.
No.
Well, then we don't have any time for more questions. And I can see by the crowd coming in that they want your seats. So I would like to thank our panel here.